Blog Talk Radio.
Joining me today's Yaron's news briefings. We're live here from Puerto Rico, from San Juan, Puerto Rico. I don't know if those of you online or watching the video, I'd appreciate your view on the on kind of a different setup. Lighting is different. We've got the contrast of the video. Video's a little different. It's a little bit more zoomed in. I think sound should be fine. Tell me if you hear a buzz in the background. So let me know. Let me know sound. Definitely let me know visual if this is better than what it was, if it looks better. It should be brighter. I've got two massive lights pointing right at me. So it should be better. But some patterns caused by my shirt. My shirt vibrates through the thing. I know. All right. So hopefully you like it. We're slowly working to improve the visuals here. I need a little bit more color behind me. It's kind of, everything's gray. Ugh. And we're black and white, right? We don't believe in gray. So we need to improve that. But yeah, let me know about the visuals and if you see an improvement over what you saw even a couple of days ago. All right, I've got tons to talk about today. And we're probably not going to get to everything. And I've got a bunch of stories that I haven't got to the last couple of times. And they're probably going to have to wait until Thursday when I do the next show. Or maybe because Thursday I'll probably be talking a lot about blockchain and cybercurrency. So maybe they'll have to wait until a different day. The reason I'm talking Thursday about blockchain and cybercurrency is I'm going to attend a conference on a blockchain and cybercurrency on Thursday, and then I'm speaking at the conference on Friday. I'm actually giving a talk on Friday on how free markets and blockchain can turn Puerto Rico into the Hong Kong of the Caribbean. So I'm excited about that talk. I'm not sure how blockchain is going to fit into my discussion. I'm going to have to make something up because that's the title they wanted. But we will make it work. We will make it work, and we will make it interesting and exciting. So Thursday, I'll probably tell you a little bit about the conference and what's going on over there. All right, a bunch of stuff, a bunch of data coming out, which I think is really interesting, both on young people's attitudes to free speech, and then also data analyzing the distribution of fake news over Twitter. I want to talk about that. And then to the extent that we'll get to it, we definitely need to talk about Donald Trump's decision about Broadcom, the so-called national security reason to stop this merger, Broadcom taking over Qualcomm. We need to talk. There's a new paper, academic paper out, or working paper from Mercatus about minimum wages, which is just, I told you so. And then there's Russia. And, oh, I forgot. I forgot. Tillerson. Tillerson was fired today. Rex Tillerson, former CEO of Exxon. I don't know if he's ever been fired in his life. He was fired today by Donald Trump. And Pompeo, the CEO director, is going to take that position. So, tons to talk about. Hopefully, we'll get to everything. I'm not sure we will because I want to spend a little bit more time on the two lead stories from my perspective. They're not lead anyway in the news cycle, but the lead stories from my perspective because they're certainly the most interesting stories out today. So, one is a survey of college students, what they think about free speech. And it's a survey done by, I think, five different organizations teamed up together, American Council on Education, the Charles Koch Foundation, Stanton Foundation, and I don't know who else, but those are the three are listed in the story describing it. And they did a statistically significant large sample size. I haven't looked at the study itself. I probably should. They surveyed more than 3,000 students. That's a considered in survey land, they're considered a large survey. Anyway, interesting results. So it clearly shows young people struggling, really struggling with questions of free speech, confused by questions of free speech on the one hand and question of diversity and so-called inclusion on the other hand. So here's some of the results, which I think are interesting, right? So nearly 90% of those surveys said that free speech protections are very or extremely important to American democracy. Now, note also how it's phrased. It's to American democracy, right? Is that the essential reason why free speech is important? It's because we're a democracy. We're not even supposed to be a democracy. We're supposed to be a constitutional republic. But is it just in the realm of political speech? Is it broader than democracy? Again, a lot of times the way these questions are phrased is tricky, deceptive, and reveals, I think, a lot about our culture. So a lot of our culture, I think, is revealed by just how the questions are phrased. So that was one question, 90%. All right, good news. 90% of these kids, of students, think free speech is important. That's great news. Better than what I think many of us would have expected. But then they also had a question about whether they think it is important to promote an inclusive and diverse society. Again, what does that mean? Inclusive of what? Of whom? Diverse? Is that racial diversity, ethnic diversity, intellectual diversity, idea diversity? What do they mean? Not clear from the survey at all. But 80% of Americans, 80% of students said that was very or extremely important to promote inclusive and diverse society. So, okay, you know, promoting inclusiveness and diversity, not in and of themselves necessarily bad things, depending on how you define them exactly. So 90%, 80%, 90% for free speech, that's a good one. Yeah, we're all for that, right? But this is where it gets tricky. Then they get asked, right, which is more important to them, right? Is free speech more important or is inclusiveness and diversity more important? Now, note that the question sets up free speech versus inclusiveness and diversity. I would argue that it's quite the opposite, that free speech encourages diversity and inclusiveness. Because the real important diversity is diversity is intellectual diversity, or the freedom of people feel, no matter what color skin they have, no matter what ethnic background they have, no matter where they come from, to be able to express themselves. So to me, free speech is crucial for diversity, for inclusiveness, right? For people feeling like, you know, they can, that part of the conversation. What's more important than free speech? But here, it's being set aside because the idea is that some speech, obviously, makes some people feel excluded. Now, that's the story the left tells us. That's the story that is prevalent out there. And that's the story that the survey, unfortunately, buys into. And it's not just that some speech leaves some people excluded. It's some speech by some groups makes some people feel excluded. So, for example, if some minority person says something that offends, let's say, a white person, that doesn't count. That's fine. Because the idea is the minority person is not in a position of power. So it's the combination of power and offensive speech. That combination is perceived to be excluding and anti-diversity. Anti-diversity. So it's that combination. So in a sense, the survey is buying into this rhetoric, buying into the story. And here, 66% of Democrats say that inclusivity is more important than free speech. And 31% of Republicans say inclusiveness is more important than free speech. So in both groups, In among Democrats, it's a significant majority, but in Republicans, it's still a large number. And more broadly, if you take the whole population as a whole, a significant majority favor inclusiveness and diversity over free speech. Again, I'm not buying that dichotomy, but the survey did, and that's the results that the survey is presenting us with. And, you know, that only serves to inculcate more in the minds of the students taking the survey, the idea that there is this dichotomy, that free speech is anti-inclusiveness when it's exact opposite. Exact opposite. What you want is the freedom to express your ideas and to have a debate and to have an exchange of ideas, even if your ideas are outside of the mainstream. And that creates a healthy inclusiveness and a healthy diversity. Here's another scary one, right? A majority of students in every demographic group. And you know how they divide these demographies. It's bogus, but they do. Every demographic group, both in terms of political party, political affiliation, in terms of, I guess, race, gender, and everything else, every single one of them said that hate speech does not deserve First Amendment protection. So every single one of them did not believe that hate speech should be protected speech. So ultimately, in every single demographic group, there was a majority that did not believe in free speech, even though they said in an earlier question that they believed free speech was very important. They don't believe in what's called hate speech. Right? Now, hate speech, of course, is a bogus idea. It's a bogus concept. Certainly, you can have speech that's hateful. But there is no such thing, just like hate crimes. Yes, there is speech and crimes that are motivated by hatred, but the motivation is not essential. The question is, you know, is it speech or isn't it speech? And if it's speech, it's protected under the First Amendment, no matter whether it's motivated by hate, by love, by cynicism, by nihilism, by neutrality, by nothing. But there is no such thing. There is no such category of speech that is hate speech and therefore is outside of what a freedom of speech, that is outside of freedom, that is outside the protection of individual rights, of which the First Amendment is one of them. Okay. So, for example, students showed overwhelming support for restrictions on racial slurs and, funnily enough, costumes that promote stereotypes. Right? They also widely supported, this was surprising to me, widely supported, according to the survey, safe spaces for those who feel upset or threatened, and free speech zones. I always thought a university was a free speech zone, but they want free speech zones where protests are partisan, proselytizing is explicitly allowed. So all the good news is out the window very quickly. Basically, we've got a generation that doesn't understand what free speech is. The things in terms of diversity and inclusiveness and intersectionality and identity politics and all the garbage they've been taught. And of course, they've been taught this. They didn't make this up. And who are so sensitive, they think that hate speech should be banned, legally banned, censored by the government, that they think then that the universities need to coddle them in case they're offended by some of the ideas they learn in school. It's just nuts. Okay. Here's a stat for you. For those of you who think that Republicans are the good guys, even 70% of Republicans surveyed supported safe spaces on campus, an idea that I've been dismissed by conservatives. I'm reading from a story in the New York Times, but I verified the stats. I cross-referenced this with other stuff and actually briefly looked at the study itself. So to verify that. Oh, thank you, Antoine, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. By the way, if you're watching on YouTube and you want to support the show, there is a dollar sign at the, I guess, at the bottom of the chat. You can make a contribution right on the chat YouTube, and it goes directly to my, I guess, PayPal account, and supports the show and everything else. Somebody says the New York Times is a joke. No, the New York Times is biased, but it's no joke. The New York Times actually provides the only, or among the few, is one of the few media outlets that actually reports on the news from a biased perspective, and you have to adjust for that bias, and you have to adjust for the fact that they're not reporting all the news. But stories like this, other stories that I often cite, only reported by the New York Times, partially because they're the only ones who have reporters all over the world actually, seeking out stories. They do some of the best investigative stories out there. And yes, they're biased. They're leftists. They're nuts. And sometimes they are unbelievably biased, criminally biased almost. But there's nothing else, because everything else is either incompetent or unbelievably right-wing biased. So the whole media profession, unfortunately, is somewhat of a joke. Okay. Overwhelmingly, almost everybody said they want an open environment that permits offensive speech. Now, again, they contradict each other, which doesn't surprise me, because they don't hold clear ideas about these things, right? They don't hold any clear ideas. Almost all of them believe that speech is being stifled in campuses. So they're pretty good in terms of what's going on campuses. 61% said that they count campus climate deterred speech. That's up from 54% just a year earlier. They also all admit, left and right, that liberals have it easier, that the left has it easier on campus. And 92% saying that liberals can freely express their views on campus, while only 69% said the same about conservatives. So they get that there's a bias here on campuses in terms of free expression of ideas. All right. They also say that discussions on campus are less relevant because most discussions now happen online, which makes sense. And a survey, I think it's an important survey. I think this is good to do. They seem to be doing this every year now. They're asking good questions. And, it's unfortunate that they're buying into this dichotomy of diversity, inclusiveness, whatever the hell that means. Again, why are they even asking that question? What does it mean? Definitions, people, and asking the kids to define it would be interesting. The buy into that dichotomy versus free speech. So that's really unfortunate. But it's good to get this kind of data and to see from year to year how it's progressing. It seems from this survey that things are, not surprisingly, given my recent experience in King's College London, that things are getting worse, not better. That free speech on campuses is being hindered more than it was in the past. And I don't need to say this, and the purpose of today's show is not so much to advocate for free speech, but let me just say, this is the issue of our time. This is very much the most important issue that we're facing right now. We have a president who is anti-free speech. We have a Congress that big chunks of it are anti-free speech, particularly on the left. We have a professorate and significant numbers of students who don't understand the concept of free speech and anti-free speech, and yet you cannot have a free society. Forget democracy. You cannot have a free society without free speech. You cannot have freedom, period, without free speech. You can't, discover truth without free speech. Free speech is a prerequisite, is a part of, it's part of free thinking. It's the idea that you are free to use your mind as you see fit, to use your mind to pursue the values necessary for your survival, for your thriving, for your flourishing, to pursue rationality. And speech is just a manifestation of that. And without that, we're dead. Without that, we're finished. Without that, we are unfree. This is the issue of our time, and for young people to have these kind of depressing views on free speech is incredibly depressing. All right, I'm going to take a thank you, Alejandro, for the support. Really appreciate it. I'm going to take a very quick commercial break, and I will be right back.
Ayn Rand held that art is an indispensable need of human life, an irreplaceable form of spiritual refueling. In the course, Eight Great Plays, available at ARI Campus, Leonard Peikoff selects eight masterpieces of world literature and analyzes them as great works of drama and as works that convey philosophies of life. After completing this course, you will better understand how to reach a full, objective evaluation of an artwork and how to grasp, evaluate, and enjoy the values that great literature offers. Visit ARI Campus at campus.aynrand.org today and enroll in Eight Great Plays.
Yeah, let me just make a quick comment about the New York Times, because I see kind of it's buzzing on the chats here. I don't think all of you should have subscriptions to the New York Times. But if you're an intellectual and you're trying to evaluate where we are in the culture and where we are in the world and what's going on in the world, the New York Times is indispensable, partially because it's so influential out there. The New York Times is now incredibly profitable. So a lot of people are subscribing to the New York Times. A lot of people are spending money and resources to engage with the New York Times. It is a cultural barometer. So if you want to engage in intellectual activism, if you want to have an impact on the culture, if you want to be on top of the relevant issues happening on the day, you better read the New York Times. Now, again, you don't necessarily have to, but I have to. I have to because it represents what is going on in the world right now. It reflects the views of the leading intellectuals in the world right now, and not knowing that and pretending to be an intellectual who could comment on the world without reading the most influential people would be pathetic, would be ridiculous. So no, I definitely read the New York Times, but more than that, I think the New York Times does a biased, horrible job, but it's probably the best job out there, certainly of reporting the news. There's nobody else to report the news. Fox doesn't report news. Certainly Breitbart and InfoWars is a pathetic joke, right? But none of these actually report news. They report a lot of opinion, and it's left, whether you like it or not, to, we'll call in the mainstream media, to actually deliver us news. How do we know that Trump fired Tillerson? Now, you know that, I guess, because you have a Twitter feed. But short of the Twitter feed, actually, before the Twitter feed, who reported on it before the Twitter feed? Anybody know? It was actually reported before it came out on Twitter. It was the Washington Post. And I actually think the Washington Post does a better job than the New York Times, as biased, but still a better job than the New York Times in doing reporting work. So Washington Post broke the story, and then Donald Trump tweeted to confirm what the Washington Post had already discovered. So, no, you're not going to find journalists working for anybody but organizations like the New York Times and the Washington Post, as much as I, like you, often despise them because of their overt, sometimes subtle, and sometimes just overt and disgusting bias. Oftentimes they just completely reject any attempt to even be perceived as objective. They're just so seethingly non-objective in terms of the opposition. All right, we got a lot to cover. Okay, another interesting story. This one from The Atlantic, but again, based on a study, and again, you had to go back to the study. Now, the study here is quite complex. The statistics are very involved, but again, from my brief analysis, these people know what they're doing. It's a study out of MIT, and these guys know econometrics, and they know statistics, and they seem to have controlled for what needs to be controlled. The data set is a large data set. It seems to be really meaningful and substantive. So what they did, now, the problems with the study, and authors recognize the problem with the study. So right off the bat, I'm going to say this is not a perfect study. You can't do a perfect study. It's too hard to do a perfect study. But this is a interesting results. So it's interesting results, therefore, worth evaluating and examining the results of the study. So the study tries to look at fake news. So the idea is, to what extent does fake news get propagated through social media versus true news? That is there a difference between the extent to which true news, true information, gets retweeted and goes through the, what do you call it, the viral cycle, or goes out there as virally? And to what extent does that happen to false news or false information or rumors? So they took basically 120,000 stories that were tweeted by 3 million users over 10 years. So it's a big sample set over a long period of time, right? And they separated it out to stories that were based on fact, that were true, that were rational, right? And, you know, they made some sense, that had some basis, that were based on something. And they separated out other stories that were basically rumors or completely fabrications or made up or really fake news, right? Fake news. And they tracked these stories through the retweeting process, right? And what they found is pretty stunning. What they found was that fake news, false rumors reach many, many, many more people and penetrate deeper into the social network and spread much faster than accurate stories. So fake news gets retweeted more often, penetrates deeper into the social network, and I'll define what deeper means, and spreads faster, that reaches more people faster than news categorized as accurate. Now, we can quibble about what is fake, what is true and what is not, what is fake and what is not. I'm sure at the margins. But I you know, what they've got here basically seems true. Basically seems true. So, you know, in a broad sense, again, I'm sure at the margins the mistakes there. So false information way outperforms true information on YouTube, and extrapolate that they believe that this would be true on Facebook and YouTube and everything else. So that's why so few people are watching this on YouTube. There's some question about why I don't have 100,000, because this is true. If I was spouting lies, if I was talking nonsense, if I was advocating conspiracy theories and spreading rumors and making shit up, which is what's his name does. I mentioned him a few minutes ago. The guy is the guy InfoWars. The guy InfoWars does. Then I'd have hundreds of thousands. I indeed millions of people, because InfoWars is massive, right? Massive, and it's all fake news. All of it. Fake news. Now, let me explain what deeper means. So deeper is interesting. So they control for the fact that some people have large networks, so that when they tweet, it's likely that a lot of their followers will retweet, right? But depth means how many people then retweet their tweets and then retweet their retweets. So how deep does it go? How much retweeting there will be, right? That is the depth. That is the depth. They even notice, which was also really interesting, that in general, people who consistently present news that is true tend to have more followers. Doesn't matter. In spite of the fact that people who tend to tweet true news tend to have more followers, it's still true that fake news, rumors, falsehoods tend to spread faster, deeper, and be bigger. Fake news prospers. And it's not the bots. So this was the other hypothesis. The hypothesis was maybe it's bots, like the Russian bots or whatever, right, that latch onto fake news and just spread the fake news out there. And it turns out, no, it's not the fake news. It's not bots. Bots tend to amplify stories, true stories, as much as they amplify false stories. Right. So, no, this is human beings. This is human beings. Human beings respond far more positively, if you will, far more actively, in a far more engaged way to fake news, to falsehoods, than they do to truth. And that, you know, that's fascinating. It's good to know. Now, they have some hypothesis about why this happens, right? Why this happens. And their basic assumption is, and again, I don't know how you test this, although they did some testing on it. So their assumption is that because fake news is fake, right, it can be far more emotional. The tweets can be far more provocative, in a sense, interesting, out of the unusual, and far more evoking of emotion. And they actually ran this through some AI software that measures the emotional content of these kind of tweets, right? And they found that fake news is far more emotionally laden than non-fake tweets. But this of course reinforces much of what I've been saying for months, years, and much of what Ayn Rand said, that we have become a culture that embraces emotions, that values emotions. We become emotionalists, and we reject reason. We reject facts. Reason and facts, they're cold, they're boring. You know, don't confuse me with a fact. Just give me a good story, right? So, and that's what happens. And they give some examples of this. So they give an example of there was a rumor circulated on social media that Donald Trump, and this is in 2015, that Donald Trump had let a sick child use his plane to get urgent medical care. And this was confirmed as a true story. But according to the team's estimate, very few people shared the story or retweeted the story, right? But in February of 2016, just a few months later, a rumor developed that Trump's elderly cousin had recently died and he had opposed Trump's presidential bid in his obituary. This turned out to be completely false, or at least there was no evidence that this was true. And of course, this spread like wildfire and was massive. Right? So hard to tell why that story about the kid, which is also emotion laden, and why this didn't spread and this one did. Could be the news cycle, could be a lot of things. Another fake story they found that alleged that boxer Floyd Mayweather wore a Muslim headscarf to a Trump rally. It reached an audience more than 10 times the size of the sick child story. So I think it has to do with the kind of stories that tend to be fake news. They tend to emphasize certain issues that people are particularly sensitive to at a particular point in time. And that's why they spread faster and they spread deeper. But they say fake news seems to be more novel than real news. Falsehoods are often notably different from all other tweets that you get in a certain time frame. Fake news evokes much more emotion than average tweets. Fake tweets tended to elicit words associated with surprise and disgust, while accurate tweets summoned words associated with sadness and trust. So different types of emotions. Hi. So here we have a interesting, you know, somebody said, yeah, but the left is purposely suppressing positive news about Trump. Yeah, but you'd think the left would suppress the news about Mayweather wearing a Muslim scarf, right? You know, that plays into, I guess, right-wing, you know, conspiracies. So, no, I don't think it's that. I think something else is going on here. I think it's much more. And by the way, a lot of the fake news stuff is spread by the right. It's not spread by the left. Most of the fake news stuff is spread by the right. Most of the fake news comes out of the right. So, and by Trump supporters. Trump supporters that, you know, indeed, Donald Trump himself is the perpetrator of some of the biggest fake news stories of the last decade. You know, chief among them, the idea of the birther conspiracy. So, no, I don't think this is left or right. I don't think that's what's driving this. I think it's the fact that we don't reason. We don't think. We don't analyze. We don't value reason. We don't value rationally thinking through. We behave on Twitter completely emotionally. We like, we re-like, we retweet completely from an emotional perspective. We don't. We forget our rationality. Greg Salamieri did a really good talk 2 or 3 years ago at OCON on how to be objective about social media. In terms of your liking and retweeting and reposting and doing exactly what people do here. And clearly people are not objective about this. Clearly people get suckered in to news stories that are not true easily because they reinforce their biases or because they're shocking and they're interesting and they're new and they're different and they're happy to retweet them, to hell with whether they're right or whether they're wrong. And that plays right in to the fake news you know, rhetoric. And the fake news rhetoric plays right into the attacks on free speech. Because the more we attack, not objectively view our news media and analyze it, dissect it, and attack it where appropriate. But the more we just dismiss the news media, the more we just dismiss news as fake news because it spreads much wider than true news, the more we give credence to the people trying to suppress and halt our freedoms of speech, the more we give credence to the people who would like to silence the media, to shut it down. Right? And we're seeing that. We're seeing Donald Trump do that, you know, not explicitly, but implicitly. You know, we still don't know why the AT&T Time Warner deal is blocked. Does it have anything to do with the fact that Time Warner owns CNN? That's not a conspiracy theory. That was actually brought up in court. Is a possible reason for the government to be doing this. And, you know, what about all the hate on Amazon? Does that have anything to do with the fact that Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post? I mean, we're really getting to those fringes where you start thinking that this, all this discussion about fake news, about manipulating the news, is going to drift into government then taking a role in deciding what is true and what is fake, what is right and what is wrong, what is good reporting, what is bad reporting, what are good news media and bad news media. And that's already happening. It's happened in Russia. Putin has already instituted that. Basically, all of the media in Russia is government media. That's happened in Hungary. Hungary, basically, the government there, or Orbán, I think is his name, of the prime minister, has basically now taken over the media. There is no opposition media. There is no media that disagrees with the government. Poland is strongly heading in that direction. And we're seeing other Eastern European countries potentially follow in the path. And of course, in England, we just saw 3 people refused entry into the country, not based on the fact that they were a threat to the English, but based on their views. As repulsive as those views in some cases might be, they were stopped at the border and not allowed in based on their views. For those of you who think ideological screening, giving the government power to screen ideologically who can come in and who can come out of the country, there you go. We're seeing an example of how that works in England right now. So it's a slippery slope, but it really is shocking what is going on YouTube from that perspective. All right, we're going to take another short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about, let's do Broadcom and Tillerson, and then minimum wage, and then maybe we'll have a little time for Russia. Although Russia comes in my discussion of Tillerson, so we'll be right back after this, I guess.
If you're interested in going deeper into objectivism, ARI Campus's new advanced course, Objectivism Through Induction, answers central questions about several key values of Ayn Rand's revolutionary philosophy. Originally given by Leonard Peikoff in 1997, the course teaches you the method of learning objectivism's principles that Rand used to discover them. According to Dr. Peikoff, objectivism through induction is the best way I know of tying your ideas to reality and acquiring a real understanding of objectivism. Visit ARI Campus today to enroll.
All right. let me just tell you now. There are no Russian conspiracy theories. This is truth about Russia. Russia is a authoritarian dictatorship. Putin is a dictator and is a dictator for life. They've adjusted the constitution to make sure of that. He is a thug. He is a brute. He is a dictator. He is a murderer. Look at what happened in Great Britain just this last week, where they used radioactive substance to kill somebody who opposed Putin. This is not the first time. These are not conspiracy theories. These are facts. These are facts. I've been to Russia. Putin is the ultimate manipulator, and he's manipulating Donald Trump like he's pulling on the strings. It's just amazing to see. He manipulated Obama. They murder people overseas on British land, on free countries' land, with no repercussions. And it's one of the worst regimes in the world today. And, you know, I'll give you an example. I mean, the difference between China and Russia, just one little illustration of the difference between China and Russia, just with regard to me. And there are lots of ways to illustrate the differences, but this is one. When I go to China, when I have gone to China, I've been to China quite a few times. After my first visit, I got a 10-year visa. I got a 10-year visa that allows me multiple entries. I can go in and I can go out whenever I want, right? I speak there. I've given big university lectures. You know, once in a while we get into a little trouble because ultimately China is not a free country and indeed is more repressive now than it was a few years ago. But overall, I can go in and out and I can speak there and I never feel afraid. In Russia, I get a visa for exactly the number of nights I am going to spend there. I get a visa for 2 nights or 3 nights. Not one day more, and every time I go, I have to reapply for the visa. I mean, that just gives you a sense of how worried they are, how protective they are, how controlling they are. And when you walk around Moscow, more so than St. Petersburg, but both, you just get a sense of oppression. You get a sense of people watching you. You get a sense that the people you're talking to are looking over their shoulder. In China, it's very open. In China, people used to point out to me, you know, that's the secret police that are watching me. But it was done in a far more open way, and people seem a lot less afraid, even though they probably should be afraid in China, particularly right now. All right. So which brings me actually, why not? Let's go in this direction, right? To Donald Trump's comments last week in a private setting as a joke. Okay, let's buy it that he said it as a joke, where he said about Xi, the president of China, that he is now for life, right? That he's going to be for life. Trump said, yeah, that's a pretty good idea. You know, maybe one day we'll have that here, right? He doesn't like this term limit stuff. He would like to be president for life. And by, I guess, by the decision not of the people, too, by the decision of the of himself. That's not funny. No, that's not funny. Not in the land of George Washington, who people begged to be king, who could have stayed as many terms as he wanted and left that to 2 terms because you realized the importance of freedom and the importance of not having an executive for many, 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 many terms, an imperial president, not having an imperial president, the importance of that for freedom. And Donald Trump can joke about it, whether it's sarcasm or anything. No, it's not sarcasm. He was serious. He was serious. Often people joke about stuff they're serious about. And you can see a seriousness in his treatment of Putin, which is a treatment with kid gloves. Indeed, not kid gloves. He was a massive supporter of Putin during the campaign. I mean, I saw all his interviews about Putin, and I go away. I go back to the fact that he justified Putin's killing of journalists. He probably justifies the White House refused to acknowledge that the guy murdered in Britain was murdered by the Russians. I mean, he folds in front of Putin every single time. He is a complete puppet of Putin and does nothing to stand up to Putin. And it's shocking. And by the way, Tillerson, who was starting to stand up to Putin, who came in as pro-Russian because his oil interest as part of Exxon were very involved in Russia, was starting over the last 6-9 months to become more and more and more worried about Russian influence, more and more and more worried about Russian aggression, more and more and more concerned by dictator Putin. That is a major reason. That is a major reason why Donald Trump fired Tillerson. A major reason why he fired Tillerson is because of his weak spot for authoritarians, for Putin, for Xi, for the princes and king of Saudi Arabia. I mean, Donald Trump has a real soft spot for these authoritarians, and he defends them. He defends them with those spots, particularly Putin. Now, sure, you know, somebody writes, Putin is not the problem. Public schools are a bigger problem. Sure, public schools are a bigger problem. No question, public schools are a bigger problem. Putin's also a problem, because as Putin gets stronger, as Putin gets aggressive, and as we Republicans today love Putin, as we want to emulate Putin more, freedom in this country will decline. And as our public school continue to educate a generation of unthinking zombies, then you're going to get more and more and more authoritarianism in this country. All right. Let's see. Yeah, Tillerson. Tillerson is kind of funny. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Tillerson's, because Tillerson, I think, was weak. I think he was way too appeasing. He preferred negotiating. You remember when he wanted to negotiate with North Korea and Trump told him to stop that we were going to fight it out with them? And look who's negotiating with North Korea now. Look who's going to the table groveling in front of the leaders of North Korea. It's just unbelievable that anybody would sit down, that we shouldn't be negotiating at any level with the North Koreans. It's immoral. The idea that the president of the United States would sit down with the murderous dictator of North Korea on a level playing field is just horrific. Anyway, Tillerson, who I thought was always weak, turned out to be weak, not that great, but I kind of find it entertaining the way that Donald Trump fired him over Twitter. It turned out that he called Tillerson after the Twitter. The way it was communicated, I don't know if you noticed, but the guy who contradicted the White House in terms of how the whole firing was delivered was accused by the White House of misrepresenting the sequence of events. He was fired immediately afterwards. So they're cleaning house over there in state. Somebody said I should vote Democratic if I want a better America, right? Sarcastically. But of course, don't forget that this administration has no different foreign policy than Democrats do. I mean, this administration is a Democratic administration, certainly in terms of foreign policy. I see no differences. Again, administration considering selling nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia is not exactly what I would say a change for the better from Democratic administrations when it comes to foreign policy. Broadcom. I have to say something about Broadcom. So the other thing Trump did, I think yesterday, was stop the hostile takeover of Broadcom. It was taking over Qualcomm. So Qualcomm is a company that makes the chips that sit inside of your cell phones and sit in cell towers. They're in the process of developing 5G. And they considered this a national security risk that Broadcom would take over Qualcomm, they're all sound the same. Now note first that Broadcom is not a Chinese company in spite of all the news stories you hear. It's based in Singapore, but it's basically an American company. It was founded in America, it grew in America, it has thousands of employees in America. It is for tax reasons, I think, based and regulatory reasons, based in Singapore in the last few years. It is in the process of moving its operations, its headquarters, back to the United States. So this would be an American company buying an American company. And yet that was halted for national security reasons. Now, what's the national security reason? This is the national security reason. This is mind-boggling. And again, I've often called Trump central planner in chief, and this is a good example of it. The national security issue is this. The government believes that if Broadcom buys Qualcomm, they will cut expenses in an attempt to make Qualcomm more efficient and more productive. Part of those expenses, they fear, they will cut Qualcomm's research into 5G networks. Now, Broadcom has said explicitly they will not, but the government doesn't believe them. The government believes that Broadcom will cut, even though 5G is going to be huge and incredibly profitable, they believe that because of the cost cutting, hostile takeovers, corporate governance, right? These are all issues. This is stuff that happens every day in America. That they will cut Qualcomm and hurt their efforts to develop 5G networks. As a consequence, the Chinese then will develop 5G networks faster than we will. And we will become dependent on the Chinese for our 5G networks. Now, that is such BS. It is so removed from the truth. And it is so intrusive into the market process. It is so the government trying to decide winners and losers. The government trying to decide what technology is the technology of the future and what technology the government should promote. This is America instituting Japanese and Chinese style industrial policy. This is, you know, this isn't capitalism. This isn't free market. This isn't so-called Trump deregulation. This is the exact opposite. This is the Trump administration getting involved in corporate mergers and acquisitions that have nothing to do, zero to do with national security, zero to do with anything, with so-called monopolies or anything else. I mean, even if this was true, the Qualcomm would cut 5G. If 5G is so profitable, you think Intel is going to sit on the sideline? You think other chip manufacturers won't jump into the fray or won't buy that business from Qualcomm? I mean, the lack of imagination, the lack of ability to conceive of how the market would solve a problem like this is so phenomenally pathetic that it's just sad. It's just sad. It's sad. What's sad is that some people continue to defend this president as some defender of free markets, of capitalism. It really is pathetic. I mean, he did the same thing with steel tariffs and aluminum tariffs. Let's penalize Americans. Let's violate their individual rights in the name of national security risk because of aluminum. Give me a break. Okay, so yeah, more. Central planner in chief. All right, I think we're getting close to our limit. What haven't I talked about? Minimum wages. All right, we're going to keep minimum wages for next time. The story's not going to go away, and it's always true. But a good story today about a bad story, in a sense, that tells a sad story, but a true story about the effect of minimum wage on teen employment. You can guess what the result is. All right. You know, I keep thinking, I really don't want to talk about Donald Trump anymore. It's not fun. And I get trolled on YouTube constantly when I talk about Donald Trump. So many people stop subscribing and drop off and leave. And I just don't enjoy it because it's not fun. It's sad. It's pathetic. I mean, this is the president of the United States we're talking about. And to spend 8 years attacking Obama and to get frustrated and depressed by Obama, and then now to spend 4 years, probably, unfortunately, 8 years attacking Trump and fighting the people that supposedly supported me when I was attacking Obama, and now I'm attacking my so-called friends. It's exhausting, and it's depressing, and it's no fun. But, you know, he does stuff, and you just can't stay silent. You know, it just is. The stuff with Qualcomm and Broadcom is just science fiction. It's science fiction. The idea that America, the United States of America, the land of the free, the home of the brave, the country of free markets and individual rights would get to the point where nobody cares about tariffs, significant tariffs, major tariffs. Nobody cares about the government stopping takeovers, whether it's Time Warner, AT&T, or whether it's now Broadcom. And there's nobody cares that the Russians today threatened American troops in Syria. Nobody cares that we have a government that is, a president who has no concept of foreign policy and no concept of the world. Now, again, maybe we've just gotten used to it because Bush was so pathetic. And before that, we had Clinton, we had Bush. I mean, we've had Bush, we've had Clinton, we've had Bush, we'd have Obama, and we've had, Trump. It's a sequence of disasters, from each time getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And I guess everybody's just tired of it. And I guess Trump, for some people, is refreshing because he's non-PC. I don't know, because he just says stuff. All right, enough. Have a great week. I will be back on Thursday here in San Juan after I'm giving my talk at the blockchain conference. I'll tell you, well, not after I give my talk, but after I attend the conference. I'll be giving the talk on Friday. Please, if you like the show, if you get any value out of the show, I just appreciate your support. Thank you for those of you who gave money on YouTube. You can do that. You can hit the dollar sign there and just contribute a little bit of money during the show. So I really appreciate that. Those of you who don't want to do it that way can easily. Somebody asked a $2 question. I guess part of the gimmick with the dollar is that you ask a question and I get to answer it. So let me just check what the question is. I apologize. I didn't really see it. ARI Rational University ranking I'm not sure what that means. Is a rational university ranking a good idea? Is creating a university, in other words, I'll take it, a good idea? I just think it's too soon. I don't think you can get enough students. I don't think you can get enough faculty. I think the accreditation, just the accreditation, would be a disaster. It's much easier to start a university like that outside the United States, and indeed, there are good universities outside of the United States, like a university in Guatemala, UFM, Universidad Francisco Marroquín, which is a very classical liberal university. The universities in Ecuador, the universities in Eastern Europe that are far better in terms of classical liberal ideas than anyone in the United States. And part of the reason they can get away with it is they don't have to get accreditation. They don't have to get, in a sense, government approval for what they teach. In the United States, in spite of the fact that we perceive ourselves as free, the government is far more intrusive into higher education than in many parts of the world that are less free economically. That's why this whole question of what is of freedom, economic freedom, political freedom, personal freedom, is a complex issue. It's not obvious. There are other parts of the world in which have better universities. It's too soon, and we don't have enough power, and we wouldn't get accredited to actually have an ARI kind of rational university in the United States. All right. We are done, and thank you again for contributing. If you want to contribute, go to patreon.com, Yaron Brook Show, patreon.com, Yaron Brook Show. If you want to contribute on PayPal, you can do paypal.me/Yaron Brook Show and contribute that way. Of course, don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel. You'll get an announcement, hopefully, about when I go live. And, I'd love to have you as a subscriber. You can like me on Twitter. You can follow me on Facebook or the other way around. I always but we will be back on Thursday with another episode. Talk to you then. Have a great week, everybody.